headlines. Boris Johnson in a tight spot. Former aide to the British Prime Minister accuses him of lying to Parliament about a lockdown party at Downing Street. Crude oil prices hitting a 7-year record high, fueled by demand optimism and OPEC's tight supply. And Yemenis raised the death toll from Saudi airstrikes in Sana'a to 20, including 14 members of the family. This is news. Thanks for joining us. The controversy with the so-called Partygate scandal in the UK is far from over. A former aide to Prime Minister Boris Johnson is accusing him of lying to Parliament about a garden party thrown by his office during the first pandemic wave. Dominic Cummings, who was once Johnson's chief advisor, said that the Premier knew that a party was being held at his residence back in 2020. That was a time when Britain was at the height of a COVID lockdown. Last week, Johnson told Parliament that he thought the gathering was a work event. Now Cummings says that he is ready to swear under oath about it. Media reports indicate that at least 11 gatherings took place at Johnson's office or other government departments from May 2020 to April 2021. Calls are now growing for the disgraced Prime Minister to step down. Meanwhile, the UK government's so-called police and crime bill has created a lot of controversy over the past days. The upper chamber of Parliament has now moved to block the highly divisive bill. The House of Lords voted against or amended almost every part of the bill. The proposed legislation includes sweeping stop and search powers for police, banning protests at key public venues, and criminalizing nonviolent protest tactics, among them the obstruction of traffic. The legislation was earlier passed in the House of Commons, but it triggered mass protests in England and in Wales. Critics argue that it impinges on citizens' right to assembly, freedom of expression, and other civil liberties. The lower chamber should now vote on the amended version. Our correspondent in London, Saeed Fursa, explains what these sweeping anti-protest powers imply.
First of all, this has been a series of defeats handed to the government by the upper chamber of the British Parliament. Some of the controversial bits you mentioned, one was a move backed by the Labour Party to remove some of those sweeping powers handed to the police that would allow them to shut down a protest as they saw fit, a protest that they deemed, let's say, too noisy or, quote-unquote, caused public annoyance, very vague terms that were criticized when it was first introduced. The government, of course, says they will always support the right to protest, they will champion the right to protest, and this is about some of those people, the repeated re-offenders, as they call them. For example, people who attach themselves to another person, people who glue their faces to the ground and bring traffic to a halt. But what critics of the bill are saying, including, for example, Amnesty International, that this is really, it represents, and I quote, an enormous and unprecedented extension of policing powers and effectively bans peaceful protests should they see fit. Another thing that it does, for example, it gives the police or it bolsters their ability to do more stop and searches, and that affects the minorities, and in particular the Black Britons, as they have been protesting against it because of that in particular. So some of the controversies caused by that, those parts of the bill. And another, for example, you could get a longer sentence if you defaced a statue than for rape. The sentence for rape here is somewhere between 4 and 19 years, but if you deface a statue, you could get up to 10 years in prison. And that caused a lot of uproar.
Brent and West Texas intermediate crude oil prices hitting their highest in more than 7 years amid optimism for a growth in demand. Brent has hit a peak of $88 per barrel, while the WTI price has gone past $85. This is in part due to a failure by OPEC and other key producers to meet targets to lift output by 400,000 barrels a month. Also news of the possibility of the Omicron variant building herd immunity in societies has made investors more optimistic about an increase in global demand. So far this year, oil has rallied more than 10%, and investment firms are forecasting that this trend will continue, saying the prices could exceed $100 next year for the first time since 2014. The Saudi-led military coalition has been raining down bombs on Yemen, resulting in heavy human losses in Sana'a. According to an Ansarullah official, the coalition airstrikes near the capital have claimed the lives of at least 20 people and wounded nearly a dozen others. 14 members of the same family, including women and children, were killed at a home. Saudi warplanes also targeted the parliament building and a military academy. The coalition has carried out more than 50 airstrikes across Yemen in just 24 hours. Nearly 7 years of a bloody war in Yemen has come at a heavy human cost. Hundreds of thousands dead, millions displaced, and millions more are only steps away from famine. The Yemeni army has launched an operation deep inside the United Arab Emirates in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says that the scope of targets will be widened as long as aggression against Yemen continues. The attacks come days after the military and its allied Ansarullah forces foiled an attack by UAE-backed mercenaries in Marib province. The latest development might change the equation of the war in favor of Sana'a.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab al-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shabwa earlier this month and made advances toward Ma'rib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
Saad Chaabi is a political analyst who joins us from London to share with us his thoughts on this, including the fact that he's a Middle East expert. All right, Saad Chaabi, first of all, let's take a look at the way that the media covers this story. Really, two stories. One, the fact that you have what happened yesterday, which was a brazen attack by the Yemeni army deep inside the UAE, hitting Abu Dhabi. And then you have what's been typical, and that is, in this case, you have a retaliation that has claimed civilian lives, 14 members of one family. But the importance that the media gives is to the other story, when the UAE gets hit. But yet, when civilian deaths are occurring, which happens practically every week, every other day almost, that story is not given weight. Is the media, mostly Western-driven, trying to shape a false narrative when it comes to this war?
Thank you very much. It is clear that the war on Yemen, the aggression on Yemen, has been supported by the Western powers, and most notably by the counter-revolution forces in the region, Saudi Arabia, Emirates, Bahrain, Egypt, and Israel. This is a clear fact. Now, the Ansarullah movement has retaliated, has defended their country, and they have inflicted heavy casualties on the aggressors. Of course, the Western media, which is part of the Western political system, you cannot distinguish, you cannot differentiate between this and that. Media, political institutions, governments, security services, they are all one system. So it is the duty of the media to justify the continuation of military supplies by the US, by UK and others to the Saudis, to the Emiratis, who are continuing to inflict heavy casualties on civilians. They are hitting civilians. It is they are creating one of the worst humanitarian disasters in the region in recent years. Yet, the United Nations, America, Britain, the European Union, they have all failed to call for an immediate cessation of hostilities, for a ceasefire. Well, I am not surprised that the media will only magnify the acts of the Ansarullah and belittle and ignore the crimes committed by the UAE regime and also by the Saudis. It's the only way to justify why the arms which are killing civilians in Yemen continue to be given to those aggressors.
I'm wondering if the UAE has actually sat down really to have calculated what it is doing. Its involvement very recently with the battle for Marib was one of the reasons why the Yemeni army issued a warning on Saturday and 2 days later went ahead and targeted the UAE. The UAE is a very small place, and you know this type of bombing is going to threaten all these foreign companies and investments that are made in that country. And this just doesn't seem like it's a very smart move for the UAE to have done. And especially now where there's been a retaliation. Do you think that this was something that was thought through? Or is the UAE actually being pressured? We know that Israel is also involved with the UAE and, of course, the U.S.
Well, there are several points to this argument. First of all, the Israelis are pushing the UAE on one hand and the Americans to do this. But at the same time, the UAE leaders appeared at the beginning, at some stages, to be smart, to widen their influence and their empire. But of course, when they become overconfident, they are likely to commit mistakes. This is one of the mistakes that they are doing, to get involved in a bigger country. Yemen is much larger and stronger than UAE. UAE only has big and tall buildings. They have skyscrapers, but they do not have the manpower. They rely on mercenaries, on people they import. They import from outside. They rely on Israeli intelligence and support. They do not, by themselves, they are not strong. And I think they are creating enemies not only in Yemen, but I am sure that Mohammed bin Salman is in Saudi Arabia is not happy with them. I know that Oman is very unhappy, and Qatar are so unhappy with Mohammed bin Zayed. But they are committing these mistakes, and possibly they are digging their own graves, because the way they are dealing with Yemen, the way they have supplied some factions in Yemen with arms as the seizure of their ship recently showed, these are red lines that they must not. They should have long time ago stopped crossing, but they continue to cross it. Well, this is how God planned to destroy the aggressors and the tyrants. He helps them to open, or he doesn't help them, but he makes them to dig their own graves, and then they fall into these graves. The UAE is playing with fire. They shouldn't do that because they are only harming themselves. The Yemenis are fighting on their land. They are defending their territory. They do not want Socotra to be occupied by the UAE. They do not want to split their country. They do not want the port of Aden to be controlled or Hodeida by these aggressors. Nobody, no other people in the world like to see foreigners coming and occupying their country. But the UAE, apparently, they have their own their own code of understanding politics. And I believe that that code itself is likely to destroy them before long.
Thank you for that, Saeed Shahabi, political analyst and Middle East expert there from London. Moving on, U.S. forces have sent a convoy of vehicles carrying military equipment and tankers of Syrian oil to their bases in northern Iraq. According to local sources, over 110 vehicles, including 60 tankers, departed an oil refinery in the northern city of Hasaka, escorted by armored vehicles. Early this month, the U.S. military sent a large convoy of vehicles to its bases in Iraq through Syria. The U.S. has stationed its forces and equipment in eastern and northeastern Syria. Damascus has repeatedly called on the U.N. Security Council to end Washington's unsolicited military presence in the Arab country. This says the deployment is illegal and aimed at stealing Syria's oil and other resources. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin, January 5th, 2022.
وفادار موندن به اسلام و به انقلاب با همه وجود به اسلام و انقلاب وفادار موند به عهدی که با خدا و با امام بسته بود به این عهد وفادار موند
He was loyal to Islam and the revolution. He remained loyal to Islam and the revolution with all his heart and soul. He remained true to his covenant with God and Imam Khomeini. He remained loyal to his duty towards the Iranian nation and the Islamic nation with complete conscientiousness in his actions and all his being. He did his duty towards the Iranian nation and his duty towards the Islamic nation. Some people try to create a dichotomy between the Iranian nation and the Islamic nation. The root of this was started by the enemies, and it is they who are doing this. Some people negligently follow the same line. Inside the country, too, we sometimes see the people who are working for the Islamic nation stop looking at and paying attention to the Iranian nation and vice versa. Inside the country, too, we sometimes see the people who are working for the Islamic nation stop looking at and paying attention to the Iranian nation, and vice versa. But our dear martyr, Martyr Soleimani, proved that a person can be the one in the country who cares the most about his own nation and the most about the Islamic nation. He is the one who cared the most about his own nation and the most about the Islamic nation at the same time.
اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد
The world of Islam has one single prescription today and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
ملی ترین بود از کجا معلوم از تشییع جنازه او
He cared the most about his nation. How do we know this? We know this from his burial ceremony. Since the time of the revolution, which has been a time of great rallies and gatherings, what other example do we have of large gatherings of the people similar to the burial ceremony of Shahid Soleimani, in which tens of millions of people participated? Who were the people who participated in that ceremony? They were the whole nation. Well, a nation could not have been shown using delusions. The nation was an existing outside reality. Tens of millions of people came to that man's funeral ceremony after his martyrdom. So, he cared the most about his nation. He also cared the most about the Islamic nation. Over the past 2 years, his name and memory have been gathering more and more importance in the world of Islam. The name and memory of Martyr Soleimani is repeatedly being mentioned in the world of Islam, and this is increasing. People can clearly see this. He was truly a manifestation of truthfulness, of the believers are men who are true to the covenant which they have made with Allah.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the city of Buji in Jiangsu province on Friday. The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture. And I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world in the Middle East and globally.
Since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an east-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these, and they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Tensions between Russia and the West are spiraling out of control. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to invade its western neighbor, Ukraine, citing increased Russian military activities along the border. Russia rejects the allegation and says its military buildup is to ensure security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Back in December, Russia proposed two draft treaties to Washington and NATO that demanded assurances that Western troops won't be deployed near Russian borders. Last week, U.S. and Russian officials held talks over the tensions. Soviet representatives from NATO and Moscow to de-escalate the situation. The talks ended without any significant breakthrough. Russia now says it has run out of patience with the West as tensions escalate over Ukraine. Moscow expects the U.S. and NATO to provide by next week a detailed written response to its security demands.
We are waiting for the written reaction. We have reasons to believe that our partners have understood the necessity to react quickly, precisely, and on paper. And they have understood that we are not going to wait forever. But of course, there are plans to drag it on and on.
Sergei Lavrov says Moscow needs legally binding guarantees, and meeting these demands would be essential for finding a diplomatic solution. According to Lavrov, his country has various options if the West rejects its security proposals.
I think the most likely thing is that they would announce that they're putting ships off the American coast with hypersonic weapons on them that could reach American cities within 5 or 7 minutes, similar to the threat they say they're facing in Eastern Europe. I think there are things they could do in Ukraine, for example, hitting the Azov battalion or some of the bases the Ukrainians have put on the Sea of Azov. They could deploy weapons to Kaliningrad Oblast. They could be announcing the targeting of European capitals. I think there are many things they could do to increase the pain level in Europe.
Russia has long warned against Ukraine's possible membership in NATO, describing it as its red line. Russia is raising the stakes by suggesting that it might deploy military hardware to Venezuela and Cuba if the escalation talks fail. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, who led Russia's delegation in a meeting with the U.S. on Monday, says the move depends on the actions of the Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan dismissed the warning as bluster, adding that the paths forward are either diplomacy or confrontation.
I think there's a chance of a compromise, but I think the chances are extremely small. I know some observers have taken some indications that maybe privately the Americans are willing to be more willing to make concessions to Moscow security demands, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Russians feel they were giving one last chance for the Western countries, particularly the United States, to see reason and give them security guarantees. I don't think that's going to happen.
Moscow and the West have had strained relations since the 2014 repatriation of Crimea from Ukraine to Russia, following a referendum in which more than 90% voted in favor of the move. The West, nonetheless, described it as illegal. The European Union and some other Western countries joined Washington in introducing several rounds of sanctions against Russia. The tense relations between the U.S. and Russia took a turn for the worse after Washington withdrew from Cold War-era IMF and Open Skies treaties. The recent tensions are definitely a cause for concern for people around the world, because if a second Cold War gets out of control, it could prove costlier than the first for all sides.
Arab intellectuals and ordinary people are still angry over UAE's normalization of ties with Israel. A number of intellectuals from Persian Gulf Arab states have announced that they will boycott a literature festival that is set to take place in Abu Dhabi in February. Omani writer Bushra Khalfan and Kuwaiti writers Munah Al-Shamri, Ahmed Al-Zamam and Ali Ashur decided to boycott the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature.
Yeah, I guess this development indeed shows that there is a large number of people who disapprove. And that has been the case all along, because we need to keep in mind that these regimes are not elected by their population, and they don't necessarily make decisions on behalf of the population in these countries.
The intellectuals have cited UAE's normalization of ties with Israel for the decision to boycott the event. The list of invitees included writers, academics, and intellectuals from a number of Arab countries. Other writers from Persian Gulf countries have also been called to withdraw from the event. The festival will take place from February the 3rd to 13th at its new venue for 2022. UAE's image has been tarnished amongst Arab intellectuals and ordinary people for its decision to normalize ties. Palestinians have described the move as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
And of course, the public communication and freedom of speech is very strongly restricted in the UAE, which means that public dissent and in this case, and of course, public expressions against the normalization with the Israeli regime, of course, can lead to consequences for the populations.
The United Arab Emirates is amongst a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States in 2020. The Emiratis opened their embassy in Israel in July 2021. Israel has also opened an embassy in the Emirates capital, Abu Dhabi, and the consulate in the UAE business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals ranging from financial services to tourism. And in December, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visited the UAE to further deepen the ties between the two regimes. The UAE was not the only country to normalize its ties with Israel. Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco have also established diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already vowed to help Israel normalize relations with additional countries in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Blinken said the Biden administration would continue to build on the successful efforts of the last administration to keep normalization marching forward.
Well, the Israeli colony is in many ways a proxy and a military base for the United States, and it helps secure the U.S. role in Western Asia and beyond. So, of course, the Israeli regime is of essential importance for the United States, and expanding Israel's ties to the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and then potentially other governments and regimes in the region is, of course, of central interest because Israel is central for the military-industrial complex.
Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stance adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
Now, as a result, of course, the Palestinian struggle has not been of any importance, or has even rather become an obstacle for many of these regimes. But at the same time, of course, it does not reflect necessarily the popular mood in these places, where many people are, of course, pro-Palestinian, to support the liberation of Palestine.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel.
Earlier this month, in his New Year message, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said North Korea would continue to bolster its military capabilities because the peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. And now Kim seems determined to fulfill that pledge. This week he oversaw a hypersonic missile test. North Korean media said the projectile launched on Tuesday successfully made a turn before destroying its target 1,000 kilometers away. It was North Korea's third test of such a missile. South Korea's military acknowledged that the latest missile launch demonstrated quote-unquote improvement from previous tests. The North seems resolute on its path to master the new technology. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes, making them less vulnerable to interception. The main feature of hypersonic weapons is their maneuverability, which makes them much harder to detect by radar. North Korea is now undoubtedly among a small number of countries, including the United States, racing to develop hypersonic weapons. The United States and some of its allies were quick to condemn the North's latest test. The U.S. did not stop there. It later announced sanctions against a number of individuals for their alleged roles in producing goods for Pyongyang's weapons program. The U.S. administration said the measures are aimed at preventing the advancement of North Korea's military programs and to block its attempts to develop weapons technologies. The sanctions imposed by the U.S. Treasury freeze all U.S. assets of those who are targeted and generally bans Americans from doing any business with them. Can such measures put obstacles in the way of North Korea's development of advanced weapons? Past experience shows that's highly unlikely because Pyongyang has been subjected to Western sanctions for many years. It has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
Those sanctions continue to implement not just food, but also medicine, technology, equipment to make life impossible for the people of the DPRK, just as they're doing in Iran, just as they're doing in Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. But I think that these sanctions are not going to have much of an effect any longer, because we have to remember that the era of U.S. dominance, of the single dominance hegemony of the U.S. is over.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The North seems to deeply distrust America. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden insists that it is open to dialogue with North Korea. But Pyongyang seems to have learned a lesson from Trump's era and his futile attempts at detente.
I think the Biden administration, while in appearance it may seem that it's more progressive or more prone to dialogue, in reality it is very much achieving the same goals as Trump and the Republican strategy in general against the DPRK, which is regime change.
Pyongyang has described American diplomatic overtures as empty rhetoric without meaningful changes to hostile policies, including war games close to its borders and economic sanctions. The latest American sanctions are expected to further complicate the situation.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام ما استودع الله امرأ عقلا إلا استنقذه به يوما ما.
Amir al-Mu'minin Imam Ali alayhi salam stated,
Allah does not grant wisdom to a person except that someday He will save him from ruin with His help.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. So, dear friends, one of the certainties that we face in life is the certainty of death. Now, whether we have experienced it in our close circles, our family, our friends, or even a much wider circle, we have witnessed that death is a certainty, and every single one of us, one day or the other, sooner or later, will end up dying. Now, death is not something to be afraid of or to be fearful. Rather, death is something that one should be prepared for. We should all be prepared for death. And how do you prepare for death? Well, you work hard in this world and you do good and righteous deeds and you try to satisfy Allah, the Mighty, the Sublime, and pray and hope that Allah forgives our lapses, and thus one prepares for death, because death is just a doorway to the continuation of this journey of life and of existence. Now, when talking about death and this this deception that the world somehow places upon people, we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says at one point, "O you who swear at the world with your tongue, but you are attached to its vanity in your heart, did the world not show you the resting place of those who have passed away in the same way that it will show your resting place to others? Were all these not a lesson for you to learn? After death, neither the weeping of mourners, nor the weeping of your friends, nor the weeping of your relatives will have any benefit for you." So, dear friends, just as we said in the beginning of the program, we have seen the resting places of those who have died. We have seen the cemeteries filled with graves of people who were once alive, walking around and enjoying the world. Now they are waiting to be resurrected. And so, just in the same manner that these graves of those who have gone in the past are a reminder for us, so too will we one day be in a grave and be a reminder for those who look upon our tombstone. And these, as Imam Ali eloquently says, are a lesson for every single one of us. We should take lesson in these things. We should realize that death will surely happen, and we should all be prepared for death. And also, Imam Ali says that the weeping of mourners and the weeping and the crying of our friends and our family members and our relatives, they will not benefit us. Yes, if they send some sort of a spiritual gift like reciting the Holy Quran in our name, or reciting a prayer, a two rakat namaz, a salah for us, or giving some charity on our behalf in our name, these things will benefit us. But the mere mourning and the grief, these things will not benefit us, meaning it is only those things which we send on towards the hereafter. These are the things which will benefit us. And so, as the Ahlul Bayt, the members of the family of the Holy Prophet, the divinely appointed Imams, they say that this world is the field from which we will harvest that which we will see in the hereafter. Another profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا
أسعد حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
أسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks. So they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child